everyone. Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. This is your host, Jeanette Brown. And today I'm excited to welcome back Graham Richmond, Clear Admit co-founder, who is going to talk to us about round one versus round two. Welcome, Graham.
Thanks, Jeanette. It's good to be back on the podcast.
We are glad to have you back. You are returning from a vacation, yes?
Yeah, I had some time away, which is always good. Coming back with lots of fresh ideas and yeah, excited to get back into the swing of things and talk about round one versus round two, which I believe is the topic of today's podcast, correct?
It is. There are some looming deadlines and lots of applicants are pushing toward getting their applications in by round one, but maybe feeling like they've bitten off a little more than they can chew. So I'm wondering if we could go over when is it essential to apply in round one versus round two? What are the real differences?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite questions because it's one that it's sort of like every year candidates, as you correctly point out, have this sort of goal of getting everything in early. And, you know, sometimes bite off more than they can chew. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, the answer to your question is that it really depends on the candidate. I also think there have been some kind of structural changes to the admissions process over the years. I mean, back in the mid-90s, when I was first kind of entering this space, most applications came in round two. So round two was sort of the biggest round by a good margin. And round one deadlines were actually typically in like October or November. And so now in 2018, we see a very different climate where round one applications are often in like early September or mid-September, certainly no later than the kind of October timeframe. So everything's been shifted back. Round one is now the largest round for most schools. So there's been a kind of change in the landscape. And I think some of that's come from schools consistently requesting that, you know, hey, you know, apply as early as you can, you know, as early as you're ready to apply. I mean, obviously, they don't profess any sort of discrimination or, you know, like sort of preference. They do indicate that you could apply in round one or round two. It doesn't really matter to them. But they always sort of caveat that by saying, you know, hey, the earlier you can get it in, if you're ready, do so. You know, we're happy to read your file as soon as it's as soon as you can get it in. So I think, you know, it depends is the real answer to your question. But we can unpack that further because I think it really comes down to the candidate and there are several other factors that we'll want to consider in this discussion today.
Great. Are there certain candidates who absolutely should apply in round one to their top schools? And if so, what's the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I would say if you are what we would call kind of an overrepresented candidate in the applicant pool, it does behoove you to get an application in early. I mean, you can think of the MBA class as being kind of a blank canvas in round one, whereas by the time round two comes, you know, obviously there's some seats that have been filled. And so if you're part of a group that is rather populous in the applicant pool, let's say, a male investment banker living in New York or an Indian engineer working in IT, applying from India. So there are some of these like populations that there are many, many applicants who fit that, you know, that sort of category. And so if you think of the admissions, you know, process as being one of building a really diverse class, clearly, you know, if there are only X number of slots for certain types of candidates, and just to be clear, I don't think schools literally say we want, you know, 50 Indian engineers in our incoming class. But, you know, they do have a sense of like, what's the diversity in the class and where are they getting people from? And so given that, it would behoove you to apply in the first round if you think you fall into one of these overrepresented populations.
So it's a numbers game. There are only so many slots and you have a greater chance when you are applying at a time when none of those slots have yet been filled.
Correct. I mean, obviously, one other thing that we should probably talk about here is you don't want to apply if you're not putting your best foot forward. So if you're not ready, like it does not make sense if you're hearing this podcast today, it does not make sense to spend the next week whipping up a application for HBS, which I believe have a very early, you know, round one deadline, because you know, you have to put a great application in to get into any of these top schools. And so I wouldn't let this rule of like, oh, I'm overrepresented, that means I need to suddenly you know, rush everything and get it in. But I think if you're, you know, if you're kind of on the fence and you feel like you're ready, you should apply early if you're an overrepresented population.
Can you talk a little bit about what helps a candidate know if they're ready or when they might benefit from taking a little more time?
Yeah, I think an application at business school, as those of you who are working on them as you listen to this podcast or maybe taking a break from working on them, as everyone knows, I mean, it's a ton of work. I mean, obviously schools have reduced the number of essays over the years, but it's still a labor of love. You have to prepare a resume. You have to fill out all kinds of data forms. You got to manage your recommenders to sort of herd them and get them to submit their materials in time. And, you know, most schools you're going to write at least one essay, if not several. And so there are a whole bunch of components, and that's not even to sort of tackle the, you know, the sort of issue of standardized testing. You know, you have to submit a GMAT or a GRE score in the case of most schools, and, you know, you have to get all these things done. And I think, you know, to some extent, if you're not feeling ready, like you haven't really had the benefit of folks reviewing your essays or looking over your materials to give you feedback. And you know, I don't advocate that everyone use like an admissions consultant, but, you know, by all means, go and talk to friends, family, colleagues, anyone that's willing to listen and who you think has a good understanding of who you are and maybe some decent copy editing skills. You know, you've got to have time for that. And so, you know, I would say if you're someone who's like sort of on your first draft of an application that's due in a week and, you know, you haven't really, you know, touched base with your recommenders to make sure that's on track, then you probably need to sort of start thinking about, okay, let's do this for round two. The other scenario that this can happen is, for example, let's say you took a standardized test, whether it's the GMAT or the GRE, and you weren't satisfied with your score and your score is maybe well below the average of the incoming class at the schools you're targeting. You know, then you might need to say, gosh, I need to spend the next couple of months refining my application materials and also preparing to retake the test. And that could, you know, result in a delay and getting you into sort of round two instead of round one.
Now, you talked about how, and I've seen this too, how lots of candidates sort of out from the gate want to try to get all their applications in by the round one deadlines. They've been working on them, they've been writing essays, perhaps they've had people reviewing their essays and gotten feedback, but they're feeling like, I can't turn in five perfect applications by these early round one deadlines. When and how can they decide to split it up? And how should they decide which schools to submit in round one and which schools to submit in round two if they do find themselves in this place where they're not confident that they can put their best foot forward by applying to all schools in round one?
Yeah, and this is a common occurrence. And it's actually not the worst thing that can happen if you think of it from a, you know, standpoint of, well, if I apply in round one to sort of half of my schools and, you know, I get into a school that I'm ecstatic about attending, then I'm done. And I don't need to even submit those additional two or three applications that I, you know, didn't have time for in round one. So I think there is a, I don't know if folks were listening yesterday when Alex Brown was delivering a webinar on this topic, but, you know, he talked quite a bit about how, you know, you may want to split things up and have a strategy which basically allows you to, you know, shoot for the stars out of the gate and then, you know, think about a plan B with some additional applications in round two if that doesn't work out. With that said, I mean, there are all types of strategies that people can employ. So, for example, some might say, well, I'll kind of, you know, get a sort of a mix of schools in round one, maybe, you know, a reach, a middle ground, and a safety to sort of cover my bases. And depending on how that goes, I can kind of then reflect and think about what my round two strategy would be. For example, if your reach admits you, you then might say, gosh, you know, in round two, maybe I didn't reach high enough. Maybe I should add another school that's sort of above the reach that I applied to in the pecking order. Or alternatively, if, you know, you only get into your safety, you might say, gosh, I need to look somewhere more in the middle range and, you know, something maybe between that middle range school that rejected me and the safety that accepted me. So you can take a different approach to it. The other thing that we always talk about is that, you know, it's rare. It's a rare thing that your first application that you prepare is your best. It's just there's kind of a learning curve. And I think what we, you know, typically tell folks is work on the kind of dream school and work really hard on it, but then maybe move on to another and refine that and go back afterwards to the first school to revisit and maybe, you know, input some of the things that you learned as you were working on that, you know, second school, so that everything you're submitting in round one is of a high caliber, because there is the danger of, you know, just whipping up that dream school application and getting it in and realizing as you work on other schools that, you know, you could have done a better job. So you want to really avoid that. So I would always say, even though your desire might be to work on that very top school application first and then get it in, you may benefit from, you know, putting it aside for a little bit and then coming back to it after you've worked on another application or two. And again, with the idea of getting them all in the first round in that instance, but still using the benefits of having worked on more than one application before you drop that first dream school in.
The idea of a learning curve really resonates with me. And this is a silly example, but I make cakes for my kids for their birthdays, and I get better over time. And I always wish, as I'm making the cake for the party tomorrow, that I had started a week before and was on cake number three with all of the requisite learning at play. I definitely know in all sorts of things, you do get better the more you do things. So I can see an argument for actually holding off on that very top school to benefit from some of that learning. But it sounds to me like maybe you're giving two different tracks of advice, or you're saying that there's not an absolute right answer. So there are some advantages if you target your very top school in round one, meaning that if you're admitted, then you're done and you save a lot of anxiety and some money, or you're admitted and you rethink what your reach schools might be. So those would be reasons to definitely target your very top school in round one. But then again, there are also some advantages to targeting your top school in round two.
Right.
In terms of the learning curve and in terms of getting better as you go.
Yeah, there's something else too, which we didn't really touch on before, which is that, you know, if the round one deadlines are, let's say, September and round two, January, and let's say you're in the middle of a really important work project that's going to allow you to demonstrate some real, you know, leadership ability or milestones in your career, obviously you might say, gosh, it'd be great to be able to report on that as I go to apply in round two, and I wouldn't really be able to do it yet in round one. So sometimes just as the candidate who needs to sort of retake a standardized test might want to wait, there could be reasons to wait if you think something big is coming down the pipeline, whether it's a promotion or a big time milestone at the office. So there are different reasons. But I mean, obviously, you know, here we are in late August. And so I think it's hard for people to completely rework their plan at this point. But I would say if you're listening to this podcast, like, you know, 6 months from now and thinking about applying the following season, you should always, you know, have the goal of getting everything in early and just making sure you have time for it. Obviously, if you're listening to it now and the deadlines are weeks away or even days away in some cases, that's where taking the strategy of, okay, maybe I'll do a couple in round one and a couple in round two, and I will adjust, you know, the round two school selection based on what I hear. Because one thing we haven't mentioned is that, you know, you're going to get some very early feedback. Most schools operate on a kind of interview by invitation basis. And so literally as soon as like October or November, you'll find out if you've made this kind of initial cut. Do they want to interview you and have you move on in the process? And if you're getting kind of consistent no's across the board, then you can, even as early as like October, November, start saying, okay, I need to, you know, scale back my ambitions here a little bit and go with a different grouping of schools for round two. And even when all said and done, I think almost every school that has an early kind of round one, you know, deadline will let you know before Christmas and well in advance of those round two deadlines. So, you know, you do have the benefit of getting some feedback and using that feedback as you kind of craft your strategy. If you need to, obviously you get in everywhere, then you're great. So it doesn't matter. But yeah.
So in some ways you could look at it as a test market round one, that you're trying things out to gauge feedback. If that's the case, do you recommend applying to a school that you're not interested in to gauge that feedback?
I mean, I wouldn't say, I think it's a little dangerous to think of it solely as like a testing ground because, you know, we're talking about a high stakes, you know, process and people really want to go to their top schools. And so I wouldn't go so far as to say that you should drop an application to a school that you're not really interested in. In fact, I learned this the hard way personally when I applied to business school. I actually applied to a school that I really had no intention of attending. It was kind of a safety school, but I spent a lot of time on it and got it in and was admitted, and then ultimately faced with this sort of weird scenario of being waitlisted at other schools and having to kind of realize that I didn't want to go to this one school that had accepted me outright. And so that created all kinds of challenges for me. And so I would say only apply to schools that you would be very happy to attend and that you've done the research on. So I wouldn't go so far as to say you can use round one as a total experiment. I just think that the feedback you get in round one, if it's not good feedback, or if it's really great feedback, can shape, you know, the round two strategy, right? Trading up or trading down as needed based on the feedback you get.
Really important things to think about. We've talked about applying to some in round one, some in round two. Is there a magic number in terms of the number of applications or schools that you should target overall, inclusive of submissions in both rounds?
Right, across rounds. Yeah, I mean, I think that, so it was quite common in the 90s when I got into this industry that people were applying to like, you know, 6 to 8 schools and really casting a wide net. And I think some of that was due to the fact that, you know, the only real sources of information on the schools were fairly rudimentary websites and going to like info sessions. And now with the benefit of, you know, technology, we have so much more information available to us that I think students are better equipped to learn about these programs and whittle that number from 6 to 8 schools down to more like, you know, 4 to 5, and even in some cases just 3. So I feel like, you know, for most candidates, applying to roughly 5 schools is a safe bet. And again, you can spread it out across the rounds to save yourself time in the sense that if you get in round one to a few of the schools you've applied to, then maybe you don't need to submit schools 4 and 5. But yeah, so that's the general, it seems like that number has come down a little bit in terms of the average number of applications that people submit.
And what data are you using to draw those conclusions?
So ClearAdmit has a tool on our site that many of you are probably familiar with called DecisionWire, which gathers data on people's admissions outcomes. Unlike LiveWire, which is just sort of a live stream of discrete events in the admissions cycle, DecisionWire is an applicant's entire story, right? So they indicate, here's where I applied, here's where I got in, here's the scholarship amounts awarded to me, and here's the school that I've chosen to attend. Or in some cases, they can indicate they haven't decided yet and get feedback from our audience and our experts on staff here. But I think that number that we see schools applied to in DecisionWire has gone down a little bit over the years. So that's helped us to kind of get a feel for this.
And I love your point about the idea that having information more readily available about all the schools helps people hone and refine their search process, right, rather than doing that as part of applying. That's certainly moving in the right direction, I imagine, not only for applicants who don't want to submit needless applications, but also for schools who don't want to see applications from applicants who haven't yet had enough time to learn about their programs to know that it's right for them or not. So that's another piece of advice, to spend more time up front at the get-go researching these schools and really trying to determine fit for yourself before putting in all the time required for an application.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we've tried to do at ClearAdmit is make that process easier. So we have a lot of, you know, information on the site that should help you to, you know, whittle down that list and refine it and learn about schools. And even using tools on the site like ApplyWire, where people can kind of post, here's the universe of schools I'm considering, here's my career plan, here's what I've been doing to date, and then getting feedback from the audience about, gee, you know, if you have this school on your list, why don't you have this one? Or gosh, you know, you have 8 schools on your list, but it's really these 4 that sound best suited to what you want to do. So I think we've tried as a company to just, yeah, provide that level of transparency and help candidates apply to the right schools and find the right fit.
Now, putting on the admissions director hat, most admissions directors I've heard speak on this topic will say unequivocally that there's no difference whether you apply in round one or round two. Are they to be believed with the same advice that you've just offered? Or do they really have an idea in their head?
This is a complicated question in the sense that on some levels, schools benefit from having a lot of applications, right? So you were talking before about, you know, this idea that maybe schools don't want to see excess application volume if it's from candidates who haven't yet figured out whether that school is appropriate for them. But on the other hand, you know, some of the metrics that, you know, entities like US News and Business Week and the FT use to sort of measure a school and determine a ranking are based a little bit around, well, what's the application volume and what percent of applicants are getting accepted? So there's this kind of acceptance rate gaming that can happen. So I think on some levels, you know, admissions officers want to have a large applicant pool because, you know, their goal is to build the best, most diverse class that they can. And so I think some of the, you know, some of the comments you hear are, I think, designed to say, gosh, you know, don't not apply just because you're going to be in round two or something. We look at round one and round two and there's, we don't, you know, we try not to be biased. And so there's some of that. I will say, though, that again, you know, per my earlier comments, if you're in an overrepresented part of the applicant pool, you know, you're better off to be, you know, first in line when they're looking at your profile rather than, you know, towards the end of the line. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that maybe we want to talk more about the idea that, oh, round one has all the really great applicants and round two is a little bit easier or something, because that's a big myth that's out there that we can talk about. But I do think that, you know, one thing that's really important to keep in mind if you are applying in the second round is that you're not only competing against other round two applicants, but you're also competing against anyone that was waitlisted in round one. And it's, you know, it's not a secret that schools are fairly aggressive, most of them at least, in their use of the waitlist, and that there are a number of candidates who get waitlisted in round one, only to then be essentially pushed into the round two applicant pool where they're reevaluated and compared with those candidates.
So it would be folly for an applicant to think, oh, I'll just wait and apply in round two because I'll be up against a slightly less rigorous pool of applicants because people who are really, really strong are applying in round one. But you're saying that, in fact, there's not that much disparity between the rounds in terms of quality because some people have strategically waited to apply later, and that round two is also going to have the candidates who may have been waitlisted in round one. So not fair to say one is necessarily more competitive than the other.
Right. I think over the years, I've heard lots of really amazing theories from, you know, admissions consultants and folks in the space about, you know, round one versus round two. And the one that I just think holds almost no water is this idea that you wait to apply in round two because it's less competitive. I mean, that just, you know, obviously people can wait to apply in round two because they're needing to retake a test or they think they're going to have a better application if they wait and have more, you know, work experiences to discuss. But the idea that the pool's less competitive is, it's really, that's a dangerous line of reasoning, and I would not recommend it at all.
Thanks for making that really clear. What about round three? When does it make sense, if ever?
Yeah, round three is tricky. I mean, even in some cases, schools have like a fourth round. And those later rounds are tricky because, as we discussed earlier, you know, the class is filling up over the course of the admissions cycle. And even if a school says, oh, we have X number that we're going to take in the first round and X number in round two, the total of those two added together is basically like 90% of the class in most cases. So there's just far fewer seats left. And it's not that the schools are trying to be unfair. They have to make sure they get the best possible class together. And waiting or saying that they're going to admit like an equal number of folks from each round would be really foolish, given that the volume is quite low in the final round too. And so what happens is there are fewer seats left. And, you know, I think, you know, schools are by the time they get to round three, they're often looking for certain candidate types to kind of fill any gaps in the class. You know, maybe they didn't get enough people from, you know, Poland or Brazil by the time they get to the third round. And so, sure, if you happen to fall into one of those categories that they need more of, you might, you know, sail through the process in round three. But that's kind of a really high risk to take. So I would say you don't really want to apply in round three unless, I mean, there could be extenuating circumstances. I mean, maybe you've just come to the idea of getting an MBA in, you know, February, and all the only rounds left are rounds three or four. And you think you have a compelling candidacy, and maybe you're, you know, somewhat unique. I mean, you know, there are folks in the military, there are entrepreneurs, there are, you know, people from countries that just don't have many MBA applicants who might say, you know what, I'll give it a shot. Even just people who are non-traditional. I remember many years ago talking to someone who was working in theater in New York, and, you know, just kind of got the idea to do an MBA very late in the game. And she applied. She was doing kind of, you know, kind of managing a production or something. So it was kind of a businessy role within the arts, but needed an MBA and wanted to get one in order to, I can't remember, set up her own production company or whatever. But and so she, you know, applied late and did really well, got in everywhere. But that was because she filled, I thought, you know, kind of a certain you know, niche that the school was probably seeking out at that point, which was like a non-traditional candidate with really unique experience and a lot of success. And it, you know, just so happened that her numbers were great too in the academic side. So there are cases where you can get in the later rounds, but it would not be a strategy that I would map out if I were planning this well in advance.
Say someone realizes they are not going to have the application that they hoped they would have in time for the round one deadlines, but they are a member of one of those overrepresented groups. Does it make sense ever to delay until the following year to round one?
I would not say that the risks of applying in round two as an overrepresented candidate are so great that you should just throw in the towel and wait until the next year. I think there are a number of reasons that you should still apply, even if it means applying in round two, if only because you'll get great feedback. And if it doesn't work out, or you end up on a wait list or something, you can use that feedback and that interaction with the school to fuel a more successful run in your second year as you apply again. And I think one of the myths that's out there is that, oh, if you don't get into Harvard or any great MBA program, that reapplying is a really dangerous proposition, because if they don't take you once, they're not going to take you twice, which I think is more true in the domain of maybe undergrad or even law school. But in the business school universe, reapplying is actually fairly common. I mean, keep in mind, most people are working. And so whether they work for another year or not, it's not like they're graduating college and need to land somewhere immediately, as you might with, say, law school or some other professional programs. So reapplying is fine in the MBA process. And actually, a lot of people get in as reapplicants. The acceptance rate for reapplicants is higher than it is for the general pool at most institutions. So, you know, I would say delayed a second round if you're overrepresented and not ready in round one, but don't wait until next year. Just apply, and if it doesn't work out, you'll get feedback, and some schools will actually allow you to kind of connect with them and hear what they have to say about your file and what you could do to improve. And even those that don't offer that service will still have given you some feedback, in the sense that you'll know whether you were invited to interview or not, or you'll know whether you were waitlisted or just outright rejected, etc. So you'll get feedback. You will build connections with students, with admissions professionals at the schools, and be able to be that much stronger the next time out.
Sort of the learning curve that we talked about before, just as it applies from one round to the next, it can apply from one year to the next, looking at round two, if you've missed round one deadlines, as your warm up. But again, not applying to programs that you would not intend to and be very happy to attend.
Exactly.
To recap, it feels to me like you are saying round one is right if you are an outstanding candidate, you've had adequate time to prepare your application, you feel like you are putting your best foot forward, let's apply. And round two is if your application would benefit for any reason from a little more time. And then in terms of spreading out schools between round one and round two, There are a couple of schools of thought that applying to your very top choice could yield feedback and perhaps an admission that would make the rest of the process simpler, being one school of thought. The other school of thought being take round one applications as the place to really perfect your process and save the one school that you are most intent on getting into for round two when maybe you have learned some things. Does that sound like a fair recap?
Well, I would say the only thing that I would add to that is that I still think that going for the school that is an absolute dream school for you in the first round makes sense. I guess I would just caveat that by saying you may not want it to be the first one you submit. Like you might benefit, you know, from working on the other programs you're submitting in round one or working on the dream school, then those other programs, then coming back to the dream school to make sure that application benefits from any learnings that you had or materials you produced in the other applications. And I think the only other thing I would add is that in round two, if you got in everywhere in the first round, you might even aim higher, right? So that could be a scenario where some, you know, even more dream school comes into play in the second round if you've just, you know, outperformed what you expected. The other thing that we didn't touch on that might be worth just spending a few moments discussing is recommendation letters.
Thank you. Yes. How do you do that? Is there a strategic approach if you're applying to multiple schools but are going to be turning to the same people to write recommendation letters? Is it easier, better for them to spread that out over two rounds? Or do you want to try to make all of your asks at the same time, even if the deadlines may be staggered?
Yeah, this is a tricky one because obviously, you know, if you're applying in round one, you've got to get your recommenders to submit their materials often in, you know, early September or, you know, sometimes in October, depending on the school. Whereas round two, it's like, you know, many months away. It's January for almost every school. So the temptation would be, oh, I'll just, you know, tell them about these three schools I'm applying to in round one and get them to do that. And then I'll return, you know, in November or December and say, hey, by the way, you know, I'm adding a couple more in round two. But the reality is you're probably best off prepping them and giving them all the materials and getting them kind of lined up for all your schools, you know, kind of making one ask, if you will. It's much better to go to them in November and say, you know what, I appreciate you, you know, doing the work, but you don't need to submit, you know, for school A or B because I've already been accepted at schools X, Y, and Z. I just think it's better. It's easier for the recommender to produce all this stuff in one go. There are enough similarities across the rec letters that, you know, there's a little bit of an assembly line advantage in terms of them kind of building the letters and getting it all submitted. So I would say, you know, it's better to kind of sit down with them once, you know, give them your resume, tell them your story, give them a statement of your goals, share with them a list of anecdotes from your work with them that you think are compelling or that you remember in terms of your time, you know, being supervised by them. And then, you know, get them logged in and get everything sort of squared away. Obviously, there are cases where, you know, you apply to a few schools in the first round and you think that's all you're going to do, but then you don't get in or you're waitlisted and you have to go back and apply to some other schools in round two. And in that instance, sure, you've got to go back to the recommender and get them started on that. But the one thing we always talk about with recommendation letters is the need to, as much as it is their job to do the recommendation, it's really your job to make it as easy as possible and to prepare them. And so you want to give them lead time. I mean, in most cases, your supervisors are, you know, arguably busier than you are. They have limited time and resources. And so you don't want to ask a recommender, you know, a couple weeks before a deadline to produce something. You really want to give them ideally like, you know, months of lead time. And then obviously you need to stay on them and remind them and so on. But it is, I would say it's a real benefit to spend that time with them in the summer and, you know, get it all out of the way, make sure they know your plan and are on board. It's easier to adjust course part way by removing a school than it is to kind of have to add something. So that's my view.
Although you pointed out that there are going to be times if you don't get into any that you applied to in round one, or the opposite, if you get into them all and suddenly you're thinking, hey, maybe I didn't shoot high enough. And in those cases, you would go back to your recommenders, and people do, and recommenders deal.
Yeah, and there's little things you can do to make their lives easier in the sense that you know, if you know what the recommendation questions were for those first three schools you applied to, and you know what the recommendation questions are for this new school that you're considering applying to in the second round or whatever, you can look for overlap and say, hey, you know, I need you to fill out this Stanford recommendation form. I'm going to add an application there in round two. But by the way, you know, your response to question two for Wharton and your response to question, you know, four for HBS really fit into questions one and two that Stanford asks. And so giving them a little bit of a roadmap so that they know, okay, this isn't so bad. I've already written a lot of material and it can be reused, you know, obviously with the right adjustments, but giving them that kind of roadmap is really important. And you know, I would say two things happen when you do that. Number one is you're more likely to get something submitted on time and to make their life, you know, a little bit easier. But the other thing that happens is that they recognize your dedication to this process. And that's why you want to sit down with them and share, you know, the materials that you're submitting or, you know, whatever kind of information you can to help provide them with signposts. And so they see that you're dedicated by the fact that you're taking the time rather than just saying, I'm applying to this school. You need to write a rec. Are you willing? Yes or no? And if they say yes, here's the login. Go ahead and do it. You know, I know that seems tempting because you're sort of like, hey, the recs aren't my problem. Once I get somebody to agree, it's their job to take care of it. But the reality is that most successful candidates are spending quite a bit of time with the recommenders, giving them, you know, that kind of feedback. So, and I know we've kind of drifted into kind of a recs discussion, and I think we have a future podcast episode planned on that, and there's much more to say about recommendations. But I think with respect to round one and round two and this podcast episode, I would say to the extent that you know the universe of schools that you're going to be applying to, whether it's in round one or two or some mix of both, always best to get the recommenders on board early.
Terrific. And what about financial aid, scholarships, housing, visas? Are those reasons that students who are applying to schools outside of their home country or who are really relying or hopeful that they'll get a fellowship or a scholarship, does that mean that round one is better than round two, or are those considerations and those opportunities universally available across those two early rounds?
Yeah, I would tackle that in kind of two steps. So for one, I would say if you're applying, you know, to a school outside of your home country and you're going to need to secure a visa, clearly or applying early is just makes your life easier. You know, you'll find out by Christmas where you've gotten in, and you can start that process and have literally, you know, 7 to 8 months of time to secure the visa. And that, you know, is no small task in some cases. I think particularly if you're applying from a country that has a harder time getting visas. So let's say, you know, if you're Canadian and you're applying to school in America, I'm not so stressed if you're applying in round two and you need to get a visa at the last minute. If you're applying from another country that's maybe, you know, sends less people to the US or is, you know, on some list, then clearly having more time is going to be quite important. So I think with respect to citizenship and location and getting a visa, applying early can make a lot of sense. And even just more broadly, like you're an international student, you're going to be uprooting and traveling really far and having to get settled in a new country, maybe spend some time, you know, setting up a bank account and getting lodging and doing all these things that are harder when you're coming from another country than they would be if you're domestic. So all those things point towards earlier application. With respect to scholarship dollars or financial aid, I think that most schools are pretty good about spreading the money they have across the two rounds. I would absolutely say that beyond those first two rounds, things get a little more dicey. There's less of a pool of money available to give out to candidates. But I think when it comes to round one versus round two, with rare exception, I don't think that scholarship dollars are gonna would be a reason to kind of adjust your strategy. Again, most schools give out pretty generous scholarships across those first two rounds.
Great. Well, I think this has given some really solid advice to people who are coming up on those round one deadlines and wanting to make sure that they are making the most strategic choices they can based on the time they have and where they are. Thank you for spelling things out so clearly.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'll look forward to circling back and going into greater depth on recommenders, as you talked about. We'll do that a little bit earlier in the round two season, as candidates are perhaps just beginning that outreach to some of their recommenders.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I would just say, for those of you kind of struggling with round one deadlines and trying to figure out this question around round one, round two, we feel your pain. And hopefully today's episode, you know, provides you with some tools and tips that help you navigate this process. I do think, we know what it's like to, I mean, I personally definitely know what it's like. I've applied to business school while working. And so it's no small feat. And I think maybe some of you will be relieved to hear that you can spread your applications across two rounds if need be, and that might allow you to submit higher quality materials for those schools that you're applying to in round one. So best of luck to everyone, and yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks again. It was great having you.
Thanks, Jeanette.
Okay, listeners, you know you loved what you just heard, so won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? Rating us on iTunes helps other listeners find us, and we want you to share the wealth. Thank you.